That's fine. Still there. This is my old-fashioned one with the buttons and everything. Yep. Yep, they are. I've got a bunch of old ones in the garage, unused, so. Absolutely. So. Yeah, I got a couple of things, one running on my laptop and one running on my my iPad, and they're both recording right now, so they'll get this half of the conversation. I didn't understand you were recording the two halves originally separately, and then we're going to merge them together, so. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Yeah, that's fine, no problem. That's fine, yep. Yeah, it's just like it's written. It's Glenn Schneider. And that should be it. And my affiliation, I'm with the Stewart Observatory Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. Right. I do, and I remember the moment extremely well. It was back in 1970 when I saw my first total solar eclipse. But let me get straight here one thing. I am an astronomer by profession, but I'm not a solar physicist, and I don't actually study eclipses as my research. I'm involved in a completely different line. I actually do work in exoplanetary systems and their formation. Solar eclipses are an addiction. They're kind of I'm an eclipse junkie. I will admit that up front. And it is more from an aesthetic perspective that I chase and watch eclipses. I have been involved in a number of research ends of eclipses over the years, but it's really not my motivation. So in 1970, I had been long into, I'd always been as a kid, and as long as I could remember, into astronomy, and had been long anticipating the total solar eclipse in March 1970 that went up the east coast of the United States. And I went with, I was I think 14 at the time, and I went with an astronomy club group that went down to North Carolina to see that eclipse. And I'd spent years reading about it and months preparing exactly what I was going to do for that 2 minutes and 54 seconds of totality from Greenville, North Carolina. I had a number of telescopes and binoculars and cameras and things all set up, and I practiced and rehearsed for months on end. How I was going to spend every second was partitioned out and set up and rehearsed. And when the moon's shadow came over, as the sky grew darker and darker in those last few minutes, and the sun was just blinked out with that last diamond ring staring up at that hole in the sky, I just literally froze. I couldn't move. It was just such an literally awe-inspiring moment. And people use those words just too frequently these days. People talk about things being awesome. There was nothing like it. There was nothing that had prepared me for it. And I just stood there staring up at this total eclipse for those 2 minutes and 54 seconds. And it did nothing else, just captured it in my mind's eye. And it was just a phenomena I had not been ready for or expecting, no matter how much I'd read about it. And when totality was over, at that moment, I knew that from that point forward, that was it. I had to go see every total eclipse after that. That was any way that was possible, I would get there somehow. And now it's so many years later, in 2017, and I've sort of followed that. I missed an eclipse once in 1985 that was logistically impossible to get to. But other than that, people talk about eclipse addiction, and I guess I'm probably up there on the top of eclipse addicts. So. Yeah, it's it. The sky gets dark, right? it's all of the things you mentioned and many more. And unfortunately, this is almost a cliche, but there are no words that can actually describe the phenomena. And it's more than just visualization. All the senses actually get involved when you're seeing and witnessing a total solar eclipse. But you're correct in some sense. For me and for many others, it is actually putting yourself at the nexus, at the focal point of the dynamics of the solar system as to what's going on. I mean, it's an experience you normally don't firsthand experience, the kind of scale of celestial mechanics that's going on with you right in the middle of it. As you're looking up at that long conic of the moon's shadow that's tracing back 240,000 miles to the moon itself as it slices through the atmosphere and becomes visible, and you see that motion of the moon relative to the Earth and the sun, and as the moon obliterates the solar disk, the photosphere, and makes it possible to view its very tenuous outer corona, its atmosphere that becomes visible, tortured in its magnetic fields and incredibly complex in its structure. All of these things are happening on time scales and distance scales that are beyond what we normally experience, and it's incredibly dynamic. And it does sort of put you in your place in the universe in a way that you don't normally experience. And it is an overwhelming experience. It's not, it is very difficult to describe. I mean, you can talk about the phenomenology and we can go into the physics of what you're seeing with respect to the sun and the various types of things that become visible. But the very dynamic nature and temporal changes that go on with the darkening of the sky, the movement of the moon's shadow, and you sort of at the bullseye of the confluence of where this is happening, it really is overwhelming. And it's easy to understand how in early times eclipses may have been taken as portents of evil or worry or concern, certainly, that the sun might not come back. We know better than that today, of course, but it's no less overwhelming. It's an incredible experience. People have described looking up at a total solar eclipse as looking into a hole in the sky. Some people, I've heard it referred to, looking down the moon's shadow nexus down the umbra as looking down God's bowling alley as he's sort of racing the bowling ball towards us. But it's an amazing event, and it's one that has to be seen to be appreciated. Well, I've been to 33 total solar eclipses, and they've been clouded out three times fully, and two-thirds of the time there were partial clouds. So I've seen 30, been to 33. It depends on how you do the accounting a little bit. Everyone. they're all different. They're all different in the geometry. They're all different in their aspect. They're all different in the phenomenology. And they're all absolutely amazing. I've seen them from various venues, from aircraft at high altitude to, of course, being on the ground and shipboard trying to get away from clouds and so forth. But no eclipse stands out as better than another. They are all very different in the experience. And I don't have a ranking. Any one of them is one of the top events in my life. It's sort of the one that I'm seeing at the moment is the best one. And then they all get reprioritized on sort of a common envelope for me. Well, trouble and distance are not quite the same thing. in terms of distance, I was living in New York City in 1974 and went to Cape Leeuwin, Southwest Australia, which is absolute right dead through the center of the Earth on the other side. I think it's about 70 kilometers off the antipode of New York City. So that's probably the most distant, although it was not the most difficult. Probably the most difficult logistically was the first eclipse I did, total solar eclipse I did by aircraft, which was in 1986. And the reason that one was so difficult, it was a very bizarre geometrical eclipse compared to any others over many lifetimes, actually. It was an annular total eclipse, which is not that unusual, but an annular total is one where the moon's distance from the Earth is just at that critical point where for part of the path, the eclipse is annular, and then for part of the path, the moon gets just close enough to make it total. And so the little total portion of that eclipse was this tiny, narrow little horseshoe between Iceland and Greenland, just this little sliver, if you can imagine that projected on the ground, sort of about a kilometer across and no more, where it was total, over a path 100 kilometers long or so. But seeing it from the ocean was a no-go, simply because of weather. The North Atlantic that time of year was not really a possibility, and it turned out to be not a possibility. So we used a jet aircraft. It was a Citation II. And you know, I've done, and other people have done, other eclipse chases by air. The issue with this one is it was before the days of global positioning. It was all based on not quite as accurate as you might like navigation. And the path was extremely narrow. As I said, it was around a kilometer, and the shadow was moving at about 6,000 kilometers an hour. It was more than the bullet hitting the bullet trying to get right through the umbra. There was almost no margin for error on that one. And we managed, with some luck and lots of work, hitting it, and we actually saw this zero-second total eclipse, which was an amazing phenomenon. Because it was different from all the others, because the angular diameter of the moon was exactly, and I do mean exactly, matched to that of the sun, we had a complete visible ring of what's called the chromosphere, this ring of reddish light on this very narrow, thin layer just beyond the sun's photosphere, shining by the light of excited hydrogen atoms, as this beautiful, complete red ring that was punctuated in sort of a dancing movement as photospheric beads that were shining through all around the circumference at different points, shining through mountains and valley silhouettes at the edge of the moon. Normally called Bailey's beads, which you see at every eclipse at one or two points, but these were just dynamically flashing around the limb, breaking up this this chromospheric ring, and we could see the corona, all this in a matter of seconds, and then it disappeared. So in this case, I was watching out. This was a low-altitude eclipse. It was 7 degrees above the horizon, so we were looking out the windows of the airplane. That's right. And, it was actually pretty amazing. I prefer, actually, to observe and photograph and such from the ground because it's a nice, stable platform. About one in every five or six eclipses I end up doing with an aircraft. I've deployed, you know, gyro-stabilized cameras, which helps a lot in photographing. I prefer to be on the ground. It's more a question of logistics, of weather probabilities, whether you can actually get to an eclipse site by land or sea or so forth, that would dictate that. And in 2013, I went with a group of about a dozen people. We used some small aircraft to fly up to northern Kenya near Lake Turkana, just on the shore of Lake Turkana. And the weather turned out, as the eclipse approached, it was absolutely horrible. We actually had a sandstorm a half an hour before the eclipse. And we thought we would absolutely lose it, but it cleared enough so we were able to get up with the aircraft to about 11,000 feet, just about 300 feet or so over the tops of the clouds. We just barely made it. And it was, you know, a small aircraft, the kind that you use for parachute jumping, and so we were able to open the big cargo bay door in the back and actually watch the eclipse with the open door, out of the open door of the airplane with no windows or anything between us. Which was actually pretty interesting, you know, wind whipping by at 100 miles an hour in this airplane for an 11-second totality, but it gave an amazing view. It absolutely did. Different than a high-altitude jet, but an absolutely amazing view. When you say mid, I was clouded out three times. I was clouded out for my second eclipse in 1972 at the southern shore of the St. Lawrence River in Canada. I was clouded out in 1977 in Colombia, South America. And I was clouded out in 1990 in a small island in the Aleutians called Atka. So I missed those three. And in 1985, there was a total solar eclipse that the path was, again, it was kind of an arc-shaped, relatively small path that just nipped the one little corner of Antarctica, which in that time of year, which was in November, was not accessible by any logistical means. I'd actually, as a graduate student, worked at the South Pole Station during a couple of seasons, and was talking to a bunch of the folks who do logistics operations and trying to figure out if there was a way to get out there that early in season. And it just didn't work. The ice pack was too thick to get an icebreaker through. It was too remote to get out with a HERC, with a C-130, unless you first flew a bunch of helicopters and dropped fuel caches and prepared runways, you know, snow runways. And it turned into a logistical nightmare. It was at a place on the Earth that you just couldn't get to then. And so that's the one that escaped. Nobody saw that eclipse. Terrible thing. Total solar eclipse. Nobody could see it. Maybe some penguins, right. No people. The other eclipse I'd mentioned to you that I had first done by this aircraft out of Iceland in 1986, actually, there were nine people on the Earth that saw that eclipse. That was the nine that were in our airplane. So there are some that are pretty remote and you do go to a lot of trouble for. 1985 was the one that proved it was too much trouble. There was just not at that epoch a time getting there. Now, Antarctic logistics have gotten somewhat easier since then. You know, 2003, there were people on the Antarctic coast, but it was reachable by icebreaker, and it went over the Machri station for the 2003 eclipse, and you could actually fly in by aircraft. So it's a question specifically of where. Fortunately, there are none coming up in the rest of my lifetime that I think are off the chart for being able to get there, but there will be difficult ones again. I don't know if tolerant is the right word, but I'd say yes. I mean, I think a lot of the people in my life have seen eclipses simply because, you know, I'm always talking about them and catches people's interest, and there have been opportunities for some, but a lot of people haven't, and I don't know if it's tolerance, but they're polite, I'll put it that way. But when you actually start talking to people, actually sitting down and taking some time and, you know, as I say, photographs don't capture what you're actually seeing, but it helps explain the story of what's going on and sort of making it understandable. Total solar eclipses occur on average about once every 16 months. That's sort of an average number. You can have as close together as 356 days apart, just 10 days less than a year. Well, sometimes they're longer, but on average about every 16 months. And you know, that's not sort of crazy for traveling. I mean, if you think about people who take vacations and travel to go to places for other reasons, I just mark my time as to where I'm going to be going in future years based on where eclipses happen, rather than some other event or kind of maybe a more normal way of planning travel. But, you know. So I'll be in Oregon. I'm actually heading up to a town called Madras, which you may know. It's actually in a very nice sweet spot in terms of the climatological statistics for the least cloud cover across the path of totality. And I would say, now that I've said that, you know, thousands of people will flock there, but something like 50 to 100,000 people are already expected in this little town of about 6,000. So because people can read weather maps. Oregon gets a bad rap, but that's on the coast. You get inland, it gets dry, and it's actually that time of year. As I say, it's very, very good expectation of not having interference from clouds. So that's the main driver for me, is going where the probability is highest of seeing it, and also being able to have a bit of an infrastructure. So, you know, if 24 or 48 hours ahead of the eclipse, weather predictions turn bad, there's a way out and can go to an alternate location. But planning on being up in Madras with a lot of other people. Well, on a number, a lot of eclipses, we actually have aircraft on standby at local airports and so forth to either get up above the clouds or to go to another place. And that may be a trick of the trade. I don't know whether it is or not, but depending upon where you are, if the road infrastructure isn't so good, this isn't for moving 10 or 15 miles, although clearly you sometimes have to do that sort of chasing if there's just local clouds. But, relocating on the order of hundreds of kilometers in the event that a weather system is coming in and you know it ahead of time. So it's all a question of time scale. When do you know if there's weather coming in, and what sort of weather are you expecting? And that sort of dictates how far you may have to make a move and whether it's at the last minute or not. Fortunately, myself, I've only had a couple of occasions where I've had to relocate from a chosen site. And one is the one that I mentioned where we actually did have to use an aircraft in 2013 that we had waiting in case we needed to do that. Another time was in Siberia back in 1997 where we were basically going to set up on a centerline site outside of Chita, and the weather was just turning really bad, and we ended up chasing that on, I'd say, about 50 to 70 kilometers from where we originally intended, and it was getting far north enough, still in the path of totality, though, able to get away from clouds. So knowing your airplane, bus, car, road system, yeah, knowing the infrastructure ahead of time is really helpful. And this eclipse coming up in 2017, there's lots of great resources, the one in the United States, that have not been available. Friends of mine, maybe people you've talked to, have prepared a number of internet-based resources and tools that will help people not only see traffic flow and such during the eclipse, but keep track of, you know, real-time weather and where there may be road congestion and so forth. So as long as the cell system doesn't get swamped, which it may locally with that many people congregating into small areas, you can tap lots of resources to see what's going on and figuring out what you might have to do as an alternative. Oh, well, I'm not sure why I slipped into we rather than I, but I do have a lot of good friends and associates and colleagues, and we often either go together or get together. It's not a formal group. It's not like a travel club or something, but we're all drawn to the path of totality. And more often than not, we come to similar conclusions about where we want to go, because we're looking at what the conditions are for the eclipse, the weather, the altitude of the sun, the duration of totality, various logistics for getting to site. And so I usually end up hooking up with, a dozen or more people, and we end up congregating, knowing where we're being, but not always the same people at the same spot. Paths of totality often give you lots of choices, and people make different choices. But after 30-plus eclipses, you really start bumping into a lot of the same people over and over again. And there is a resource which is called the Solar Eclipse Mailing List, which is actually today a Yahoo-based email exploder. It's been around for about 20 years or so in a couple of different formats. And globally, eclipse chasers and a number of files communicate and talk to each other, not only privately by emails and such, but through this email exploder that goes to hundreds, if not thousands, of people when it's replicated around the globe. And there's been lots of interest in that, of course, with the big eclipse coming up in a couple of months in the United States. Oh God, that's a tough number. I don't even want to take a guess on that. I know that there are thousands of what you might call diehards, because those are the numbers of people that keep tripping over. I would be really hard pressed to actually get a number globally. I think that's a demographic I don't have. I would think so. It's certainly over. Well, it depends upon. I'm not talking about somebody who is seeing every eclipse, but they will pick and choose and have seen 3, 4, 5, 6 eclipses. A lot of this is made possible. I mean, people have different aspects and avenues available to them. I mean, the travel industry itself has latched on to making popular, quote, eclipses available to people easily. There are always these eclipse cruises, for example, that are going, and you get 3 or 4 of these cruise ships, and you're already booking thousands of people right there onto several cruise ships. So, the numbers aren't that crazy. I mean, you get 4 ships going into the Pacific that are 1,000 passenger class ships or so. Now, already you're driving the numbers up into thousands just for that. Then you get eclipses like this one in 27, the one coming up, which is going over 14 states in the United States from the northwest to the southeast, completely across the country. And there's going to be millions of people living right within the path of totality. Whether some of them will become eclipse chasers or not is hard to say. I think some of them will. The eclipse that went up the east coast of the United States in 1970 inspired a lot of people of my generation, and have continued to go back and see many eclipses since then. So, not personally, but I know of Don quite well from the work that he did in aircraft eclipses, particularly back in the 70s and 80s. Right. He's lucky in that sense. That's right. So I really envy people where total eclipses fall in their backyards, but it does happen. No, it's not. But you know, eclipse chasers and I think meteorologists share a common saying, and that's climate is what you expect, but weather is what you get. So weather can treat you kindly or it can treat you unkindly. You never really know. You can go where the statistics say that you're going to be best on a climatological basis, and the day of the eclipse, almost anything can happen. You just, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yep. It does. Yep. And I've had opposite events with eclipses, actually. In 1976, I was on the top of Mount Delegate in Australia, which is not a huge mountain. It's more like a giant hill. It's probably, if I remember right, about, I don't know, 1,200, 1,400 meters up above the sort of rolling plain below, where there's a lot of cow pastures and all. And that eclipse, we thought for sure we were going to lose it, and actually a little hole opened up in the clouds just before totality, and the eclipse shone through the hole in the clouds, which is an amazing thing. Perfectly clear patch of blue sky with the rest of the sky absolutely horrible, just in the right place for us. So sometimes you get lucky. And then in 1977, just the year later, one that I'd said had been clouded out of, was exactly the opposite. The sky was completely blue up until about 10 minutes before totality. One little cumulus cloud that was like 5 degrees by 15 degrees, sort of football-shaped little cumulus cloud off towards the horizon, just drifted in front of the sun right at the wrong time, and we lost it just before totality. So it can go either way. You know, the best of plans sometimes can get foiled, but you do your best. You can't win them all. It's a horrible thing, but it happens. Well, kids growing up now have a different perspective than I think we did. I mean, clearly you're right. It's not that people didn't talk about the possibility of exoplanets, although I'm not sure we used the term exoplanets back then. But it was, you know, complete speculation. It wasn't until 1995 that with 51 Peg that there was a confirmation of a first exoplanet. And now we've got thousands of candidates with Kepler and other techniques. So it became an explosive field when I first got into it. It was kind of out there on the fringes. And actually, my work is not so much on the exoplanets themselves, but in the environments that they are born out of and that they replenish. Actually, most of my work is in circumstellar disks and circumstellar material and planet-forming systems, kind of understanding the forest, not just the individual trees. Trees are important, but you got to understand the environments as well. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, you know, in a generation, it's a completely different understanding of solar systems, plural, not just our own. And it's the kids growing up with it, I mean, that's going to be the norm for them. It's still, I mean, even as an astronomer, it takes adjustments from growing up with the then 9 planets in our solar system being it to now, you know, without any question or hesitancy, knowing that we're just one little tiny component of that. Right. Right, like we lost something in some sense. Right. Oh, yep. I think there's such an emotional connection that gets made with the total solar eclipse beyond the sort of rational scientific way of thinking about it or just from a phenomenological perspective. I think your kids will be bowled over just as much or more so than adults will be. It's an amazing thing. It really is. It does. Now there is. I would say there's nothing for me that equates. There really isn't. It's the number one of natural phenomena that you can experience as a human. I think there's other eclipse chasers will probably tell you the same thing or similar. It's the reason that we do this. It's almost incomprehensible if you haven't seen one. But it does do something to you. It really does. But after this one, maybe you will. After this one, you probably will. But no, you do. You really do. But right. Yep. Right. Yeah, that's fine. Maybe just two things, and maybe you can convey this as you start putting things together, and maybe you already have, for people who are considering whether they should go to the trouble, you know, well, I live 50 miles away, well, I live 100 miles away versus, well, I live 10,000 miles away, which, of course, is a different effort. And that is, they're going to be hearing a lot about the partial eclipse, the partial phases of the eclipse versus the total eclipse. And they're completely different phenomena. And what I think people underappreciate or don't appreciate is that they are completely different phenomena. Even when you have 99.5% coverage of the sun with just a little tiny sliver of the photosphere left, it's still a partial eclipse. And you don't experience any of the unique phenomena that you do when you're inside of the moon's umbral shadow. So people who live 20, 30 miles away will often think, oh, I'm going to see better than a 99% eclipse. I can just stay where I am. You need to make that effort, especially when you're close. It's you know, I certainly can understand people weighing, gee, do I really want to travel 1,000 miles? I'm not an eclipse chaser. I would say yes, but it's the people that are nearby that really need to understand there's a tremendous distinction. It's terrible that they're actually called by the same name. They both are eclipses, but the phenomena are so different And I think a lot of people think that they have seen total eclipses. They think, oh yeah, 30 years ago we had this eclipse back in my hometown. And, well, no, that was a partial eclipse. That was a different thing. So help to draw that distinction to people. I think it makes a big difference, and it does a great service if they can understand that it's, because a lot of people will see a 99% partial eclipse and go, yeah, it wasn't that big a deal. I don't know what all the fuss was about. And that's why. It's not the same thing. Well, good luck with the weather. Next one is in 2019, July, in Chile, and Western Argentina. Actually, all of Argentina, but the further west you go across Chile and Argentina, the lower the sun gets. It's actually out over the Pacific Ocean, and then towards sunset it hits that southern part of South America. So, unfortunately, the weather isn't the best time of year then for an afternoon eclipse, but that's where it's happening. So, making plans for that now. May go to a high-altitude observatory site. It goes over to Lolo. It goes over where the Magellan telescopes are. Basically, the high-altitude sites inland from the coast, and may just have to deal with the weather. Another one of these cases where there's just limited. I'm sure there will be boats that go out, but I think I'd prefer to have my feet on the ground for that one. But sometimes choices are not the best, but sometimes you have to take what you get. What's your email quota limit or something? Because I can. Okay, I'll check the file when I stop it. I'll try emailing it. If it bounces back, I'll put it on a web server or something for you to grab. Oh, okay. Okay, will do. Gotcha. So angry. Oh, that's not good. Yep. All right. Well, I will send it. Just send me a quick confirmation back that you've gotten it. If I don't hear from you in a day or so, I'll just assume you haven't received anything. I'll put it on a web server or something for you. Oh yeah, it always happens. Sort of about it's accelerating, and that's fine. There's great public awareness. There's been a lot of outreach that's already happened on this eclipse, and I think most of it is pretty positive, which is good because there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of people to see something really unique, and so. Take a look, for example, at what happened in Australia in 1976. Actually, if you pop to my website, I think you have it. Just look for the 1976 link. The Australian Ophthalmological Association somehow took the stance that there was no safe way to view an eclipse, whether it was total or partial, and they didn't draw any distinction, and scared everybody silly that the only safe way to see the eclipse was on television or read about it in the newspapers. And so that's the case where things did not go very well. Since then, of course, and especially there's been lots of work with public outreach. A major activity was undertaken in Australia in 2012 to reverse that by Terry Cuttle, who led a big education and public outreach campaign, which is very successful. And of course, here in the United States, there's been a lot of that either coordinated through the American Astronomical Society and other organizations. And information has been getting out in a much better way, I should say. And I'm sure you've came across a lot of the web resources that have become available, too, on social media. So, Yep. I actually heard there was a recent meeting. There have been several workshops on the solar eclipse. There was one in South Carolina about a month or two ago, which I didn't attend in person, but it was streamed, and I was listening and sending in remotely on some of that. But I'd heard a statement, and I'm trying to remember what you would know better than me. It was some professional TV news, TV radio media reporting group representatives there, who were projecting that on the day of the eclipse, this was probably going to be the largest amount of news coverage for a positive, good event since the moon landing. Which to me, I thought was kind of incredible. But at least within the United States, that's what they were predicting. So that's what people were saying, which to me sounds over the top, actually. But no, I think in this time, what they're really talking about, there's going to be lots of real-time handoff across the country as the eclipse progresses from Oregon to South Carolina over that period of time. There's been going to be just tremendous amounts of real-time coverage handing off from one location to another. Oh, I know. No, absolutely. Well, we'll see. We'll see. By the way, you asked me two things. You asked me if there was anything else that should be conveyed. One was I was saying people really need to understand the difference between partial and total eclipse. And the second is if they're in the path of totality and if it's their first eclipse in particular, my advice, if they want to take pictures or they snap something with their iPhone or something, that's fine. But first total eclipse, don't get yourself involved in a major photographic project. A lot of people do, and they end up spending a lot of time and fumbling around with cameras and missing the event. And it's all about capturing. You can always do that if you get addicted. You can always do that on your second or third eclipse. But your first experience, you don't want to be distracted handling machinery while you're watching totality. So...
that's true. Yep. Okay, sounds good.
It is going to be a 20-hour drive from Tucson, so yep. So, all right, I appreciate that. Yeah, I'll send this to you shortly. Thanks. Clear skies now.